Greetings and welcome to the Science Podcast for December 8th, 2006. I'm Stuart Wills, the online editor of Science Magazine. Today, we begin our trip on Mars with some startling new evidence for water on the Red Planet. After that, we'll swing through West Africa for a disturbing look at how the Ebola virus is threatening great ape populations there, and wind up with a visit to the world of scientific entrepreneurship with Science Careers columnist Peter Fisk. Along the way, we'll make brief stops to look at a distant binary star system and at a new wrinkle on biofuels. All that, plus our usual roundup of other stories from science and its daily news website, Science Now. So stick around. At the top of the show today, Mars. As we all learned several weeks ago, the Mars Global Surveyor spacecraft, which has orbited the fourth planet and beamed a steady stream of data back to Earth for more than 9 years, went suddenly silent on November 2nd. That brings to an apparent end the longest and most productive mission to Mars. But fortunately, before the spacecraft clocked out, it had sent back to Earth almost a quarter of a million images of the Martian surface. In this week's Science, Michael Malin and four colleagues from Malin Space Science Systems in San Diego, California, report on their latest work mining that rich vein of data, an effort that has resulted in some startling new insights on the recent geological history of the planet, including the possibility of water on Mars. Dr. Malin is on the line with us now to tell us more. Dr. Malin, welcome to the Science Podcast.
Thank you.
Well, Dr. Malin, in this study, you're looking really at two different issues, if I understand it correctly, the rate of impact cratering on Mars and some new evidence for recent flows of water there. But if I understand the paper, you're using a similar technique to approach both questions.
Yes. In fact, the important part of this comes out of the fact that MGS did, in fact, have such a long-lived mission. What we've done in both these studies was to compare photographs that we took in 1999 and 2000 to photographs that we took more recently in 2006.
Let's first look at the water part of the paper. About 6 years ago in Science, you reported some other very exciting evidence from Mars Global Surveyor in the form of gullies that looked like possible evidence of recent liquid water flows. What does this new work add to that study?
We actually caught a couple of these that have actually been active since 2000. We had speculated that they looked so young that they were likely to be active, or they could likely be active today, but we had no evidence to prove that. What we now have in two gullies out of 10,000 gullies that we have studied, we have two that have fresh deposits that move down the channel of the gully and spread out at the base of the gully, indicating that something had actually happened since we first took pictures. So we have before and after pictures.
Well, you have before and after pictures of some landforms or, you know, surface forms. What is the evidence that these things look like water flows?
The evidence is geomorphic, which means how it looks and how it drapes and moves around the topographic features. So the flows that we see, or the features, we'll call them flows, were moving down a slope. They branched around very small obstacles. The downslope ends of these flows have long strands, and it appears to be a very thin deposit, and it's also light-toned. It looks bright relative to the surrounding surface. The bright tone is very odd for a Martian feature that is fresh and new. On Mars, when something new happens, it disturbs the ground, and once the ground is disturbed, the very thin veneer of dust gets disturbed and churned up, and the ground looks dark. So to see anything that has a light tone that has recently formed is very, very unusual.
Well, you also report in the same paper on some new findings on recent impact cratering on Mars. How did your team sort of get involved with that problem?
Well, that's a very interesting story. Basically, we were just taking pictures, and one of my colleagues here, Ken Edgett, who's a co-author on the paper, noticed in one of the low-resolution pictures that we'd taken a dark spot that he didn't remember having been there. Well, that's an incredible ability to actually have been able to remember hundreds of thousands of pictures we've taken and a given location and think that, you know, I don't remember seeing that black dot before. And he called it to my attention, and we picked around what it could be. And so we re-photographed it with the high-resolution camera and, in fact, saw that there was fresh crater at that location.
And then from there, you went on to look sort of more broadly for other examples of these kinds of changes?
That's right. And what we did is we came to the realization that, yes, indeed, what was happening here was that the shock wave from the impact was blowing dust off the ground, creating a dark spot. So we went back and re-photographed about 30% of the planet in January, February, and March of 2006 and compared the new images with the images that we took in 1999. And we found about 40 new spots, half of which turned out to just be wind effects. But the other 20 were real new fresh craters.
And what does that tell you? What are the main things we're learning from this part of the study in terms of cratering on Mars?
The important thing that came out of that part of the study is that what we found was that there was a certain cratering rate, and this has been something of considerable interest to planetary geologists for many decades. And in the absence of knowing what the cratering rate, people had thought about how you would determine the cratering rate and what goes into determining the cratering rate. So they had taken the rate at which craters form on the moon and scaled that cratering rate to Mars because Mars is closer to the asteroid belt. It turns out that these models can be very specific about what they would predict, and they are very consistent with what we've actually found. Now, ultimately, this is important because of two things. First, we use the gradual accumulation of craters on a planet to determine how old things are. As time progresses, more and more craters form on a given surface. And this now allows us to use those crater age determinations with higher credibility. The second thing is that this helps validate our ideas of where objects that are hitting Mars and where objects that are hitting the Earth and Moon are coming from. And this has implications for assessing the risk to the Earth of being hit by large asteroids.
Okay, well, we have this wonderful new data and new study that you've provided. Obviously, the Mars Global Surveyor may not be in the Martian skies anymore. Where do we go from here?
Well, first of all, while MGS has not communicated with us for almost a month, that doesn't mean it's completely gone. It's still in orbit of Mars, and there have been satellites, in particular SOHO, which is a satellite that was orbiting the sun, that after a number of months, when sunlight fell on their solar panels because of the odd orientation it had gotten itself into, SOHO came back. And so there is still ongoing an effort to try to determine what has happened to MGS and to find it. And we're all very hopeful. I mean, I have lots of things I want to use the cameras on that spacecraft for. So we're going to hold out hope that maybe MGS isn't dead, it's just incapacitated.
Well, Dr. Malin, congratulations on this work, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Michael Malin is the president and chief scientist of Malin Space Science Systems. He and four colleagues report on their recent findings on the geology of Mars in the December 8th issue of Science. And speaking of unearthly matters, this week Science investigates a little case of interstellar cannibalism. Joanne Baker of Science International in Cambridge is with us now. Joanne, what's this all about?
Well, most stars actually live in paired or in binary systems. And the stars in those binary systems can often have unequal sizes. And so the larger star in the binary can sometimes suck gas off from its smaller companion star. So in a way, over time, the larger star can totally cannibalize its little companion. The smaller star can get so much gas sucked off it that it can actually become too small to sustain burning of hydrogen. So it stops glowing. And that small companion then will be known as what astronomers call the brown dwarf. Brown dwarfs are very, very dim, very faint stars, and they're very difficult to see next to the light of their very sort of larger companion. And if you take that binary system, so over sort of millions or perhaps billions of years, the stars will age, and the larger star will end up as a white dwarf, which is just a very dense, sort of like the embers of a star like the Sun. And it's still just slowly sucking gas off the little brown dwarf companion, which causes the whole thing to sort of flicker. And so these sorts of stars are called cataclysmic variable stars because of the flickering.
So these cataclysmic variable systems are thought to be made up of these white dwarf, brown dwarf pairs, but I guess it's been very hard to observe these brown dwarfs. Is that the crux of the problem?
Yes. The theory predicts that sort of two-thirds of all of these variable binary systems should have brown dwarfs as the second star in the system. But actually no one has seen that, and that's because the glare from the white dwarf is actually too bright.
And now in this new paper in Science, someone's actually seen one of these brown dwarfs, or at least been able to detect one.
Yes, so they've actually gone to a very large survey of stars called the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, and they've picked out this star from there. So because the Sloan Sky Survey picks up so many stars, they can choose ones which are fairly faint, where the glare is much less. So then it's easier to spot the brown dwarf. And what they've done is actually take a series of very fast photographs of the star, and they've watched eclipses when the brown dwarf passes in front of the other star every 82 minutes. And they've modelled the brightness of the star and worked out that the brown dwarf has a mass of just 5% of our own sun. So it is a true brown dwarf companion.
And what's the significance of this observation, Joanne?
Well, it's the first time that a brown dwarf has been seen in a cataclysmic variable system. So the authors, Stuart Littlefair and his colleagues, they predict that there should be many more of these in large surveys, such as the Sloan Survey. And they've also reckoned that the brown dwarf was more bloated than theory predicts. And so that's challenging people's basic models for the physics of brown dwarfs. So they're going to go out and look for a lot more of these brown dwarf binaries, these cannibalistic systems.
Well, Joanne, thanks for dropping in.
Thank you.
Coming up in a moment, the Ebola virus's devastating effect on gorilla populations.
Did you know that the journal Science was founded by Thomas Edison in 1880? Even Edison's inventive mind could not have imagined its evolution into the world's leading journal of groundbreaking research and scientific news, in print and online. AAAS members can access seminars, podcasts, and all issues since 1880. Read today's stories and preview tomorrow's research, all at www.sciencemag.org. AAAS, advancing science into the future.
For years, the dreaded hemorrhagic fever, Ebola, has been devastating great ape populations in Western Africa, but the disease's extent and transmission have been something of a puzzle. Now, a new paper in Science's Brevia section by Magdalena Bermejo and colleagues has added some needed new insight on how the disease might spread within great ape populations. Science News correspondent Gretchen Vogel covers the story in the journal's December 8th issue. She's on the line with us now. Gretchen, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Gretchen, remind our listeners of what Ebola is and tell us something about the magnitude of this problem among the great ape populations in Africa.
Ebola is a hemorrhagic fever that has gained certain notoriety as a cause of several epidemics in Central Africa over the last couple of decades. And when it hits humans and great apes, the virus sets off a cascade of immune responses that end up with some pretty gruesome symptoms, including bleeding from various orifices, and most people do not survive once they've been infected. That seems to be the case for great apes as well. And in places where the virus has hit great ape populations, scientists estimate that up to 90% of the chimpanzees and gorillas that were in those areas have died of the disease. But it's been very difficult. This is a region of very thick jungles and very few roads, and it's been difficult to gauge the extent of the epidemic in the great ape populations. And this paper attempts to put some more exact numbers on what's happening, especially among gorillas, in the region of the Losi National Park in the Congo.
And so what did they actually do to constrain that problem better?
Well, Magdalena Bermejo and her colleagues have been working with gorillas in the region for about a decade, but in 2002, they noticed that suddenly most of their group, they had about 140 gorillas that they had tracked. They realized that they were suddenly dying, and they suspected that it might be Ebola, but they weren't sure. So between October 2002 and January 2003, 130 of the 143 gorillas that she and her colleagues had been studying died or disappeared. Because they suspected Ebola, they wanted to more carefully document the situation, and so over the next few months, they identified a number of other social groups in the region and started watching carefully to see what happened to them. They counted their nests at night to make sure they knew exactly how many members were in each group. And sure enough, in October 2003, they started seeing animals dying again or disappearing. They aren't sure that Ebola was the cause of death for every single one of those animals, but they did test a number of corpses, which is pretty difficult to do in this really thick jungle area and with such a dangerous virus as Ebola, but they managed to test at least 12 carcasses, and 9 of them indeed were positive for Ebola. To get a number for how many gorillas in this region had died, they did larger transect studies where they simply walked in straight lines and documented the signs of gorillas or chimpanzees. And you can tell by doing these transect studies sort of what the population density is of the great apes in that region. And they found that in a certain region west of a sort of demarcation line that there were 90% fewer great apes than in regions east. And they then calculated from there that 90% of the existing chimpanzees and gorillas had probably been wiped out by this epidemic. And they could extrapolate from the areas in the east that hadn't yet been affected by the disease what the population density could have been in the area where Ebola had already gone through. And they came up with a number then of about 5,000 gorillas that had died over the last a little bit more than a decade.
Wow. But I think these findings also had something to say about transmission, didn't they?
That's right. On the smaller level, as they were following the individual groups, they were able to record when certain animals disappeared and when each group sort of took a hit from what they assumed was the disease. And they found that the disease seemed to move through the groups at about the same rate as the human incubation period for the diseases. It seemed that the lag time between deaths in neighboring groups was about a little bit more than 11 days, and the incubation period in humans is 12 days, and presumably about the same in great apes. So they were able to show that the virus was sort of moving in a wave through these groups. They weren't able to directly show in this paper direct contact between an uninfected and an infected gorilla that could have been the cause of spreading the disease, but the circumstantial evidence is very strong.
So the circumstantial evidence suggests ape-to-ape transmission rather than some other mode of transmission.
At least on this scale, correct. The disease has popped up in various places across Central Africa, this Ebola Zaire strain, as it's called. And so it's pretty clear that there is something else going on as well. It's not just ape-to-ape transmission. But in this particular region of Gabon and the Congo, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, it looks as though ape-to-ape transmission is the primary way that the epidemic is spreading.
And do these findings suggest anything about how the disease might be stemmed in these ape populations?
It's a very difficult question, but these findings to some people do offer a glimmer of hope, because if the disease is sort of spreading in waves across ape populations, then you can at least predict where it's going to perhaps affect apes next. If the main way apes are catching this disease is through some other reservoir species, say bats or birds, that can carry the virus without getting sick themselves, then it's very difficult to predict which group might get hit next. But if, as this paper seems to indicate, the disease is spreading from ape to ape and from group to group, then you can sort of figure out, as you can in human populations, what the most vulnerable groups might be. You could, in theory, then target those groups with some sort of vaccine, which scientists are feverishly working on several vaccines that might be useful for preventing the disease in human populations. And certain scientists think that might be useful to try in the ape populations as well. Unfortunately, that comes with a pile of difficulties. How do you vaccinate wild apes? People are hoping that maybe some of the vaccines might be useful or might be amenable to applying to bait, for example, and that you could then maybe load fruits with the vaccine, and then the apes could take them orally and would pick up the fruit and would be able to then be vaccinated sort of a little bit passively without having to dart every single ape and then injecting them, which would be very, very difficult in this terrain. But it's not clear what the other environmental impacts could be of setting out such a vaccine in the wild.
Well, obviously, this is a disease, as you mentioned, that occurs in humans as well. Do these findings have anything to say about human Ebola risks and how they might be minimized?
One of the very important lessons from the recent studies of Ebola is that most often the human outbreaks can be traced to people catching Ebola originally from wild animals, either great apes that they were hunting or that they found and then brought back as a food, or perhaps the disease does affect other animals in the forest as well. So the practice of bushmeat hunting, which is prevalent in the area, is especially dangerous. And so both conservation and health workers are trying to encourage people to certainly not touch any dead animals that they find in the forest, and also to cut back in general on bushmeat hunting so as to try and prevent human outbreaks of Ebola as well. And if, again, the disease is spreading from ape to ape and one can sort of tell where it might hit next, one can concentrate one's public outreach efforts on the human populations that might be in the path of the disease.
Well, Gretchen, thanks very much for giving us a look at this story.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure.
The paper by Magdalena Bermejo and five colleagues on the Ebola outbreak, as well as Gretchen Vogel's news article on the study, appear in the December 8th issue of Science. Also in Science this week, a paper that offers a promising new spin on biofuels. Andrew Sugden of Science International in Cambridge is with us now. Andrew, we hear a lot about biofuels these days. What makes the biofuels being reported here different?
Well, at the moment, most biofuels, such as corn grain ethanol or soybean biodiesel, come from monocultures of plants grown on fertile or on artificially fertilized soils. And their advantages are that they're renewable, and their use produces less carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas than to fossil fuels. In the jargon that we use, they're less carbon positive. But the downside is that they often require fertilizer inputs, and they can also have bad consequences for biodiversity. And even though they're less carbon positive than fossil fuels, they're still carbon positive. And now this new work by David Tillman and his colleagues indicates a new approach to biofuels that addresses many of these disadvantages, and even to the extent of being carbon negative, that is, achieving a net reduction in atmospheric CO2.
Well, that seems almost like magic in a way. I mean, these biofuels are still being burned. How can they be carbon negative?
Well, we need to look at the experiments that the researchers did here. And what they did was to take plots of plants grown in agriculturally degraded lands in the U.S. Midwest. And they planted up these plots with different numbers of plant species, and they measured basically two things. First, the above-ground bioenergy yields of the plots, and secondly, the below-ground carbon accumulation, in other words, in the roots and in the soil. And they found that the highest diversity plots, those with the most plant species, produced the most bioenergy, and also, very interestingly, that the accumulation of carbon in the roots and soil outweighed the loss of carbon to the atmosphere through the burning of the above-ground parts. And these patterns weren't just short-term. They were maintained through the 10 years of the experiment. And for the high-diversity plots, the greenhouse gas reduction over fossil fuel was 16 times greater per hectare than corn grain ethanol or soybean biodiesel.
Wow. And so this carbon negative effect comes entirely from the increased diversity?
The higher diversity produced a greater carbon negative effect, but even having two species as opposed to one also produced a significant effect.
So how much energy are we actually talking about potentially from this source?
Well, that's a more tricky question. If one was to take all of the world's degraded lands and turn them over to this type of low input or higher diversity biofuel crop system, they really could make a substantial contribution. The authors estimate something like 13% of global petroleum consumption for transportation, for instance, or even up to 19% of global electricity consumption. But this, of course, would depend on these results being applicable in other degraded lands elsewhere.
Well, Andrew, thanks a lot.
Not at all. It was a pleasure.
Just around the corner, bringing an entrepreneurial spirit to a scientific career. Stay with us.
Did you know that AAAS members help plug the power of science into public policy? Since 1973, we've brought nearly 2,000 scientists and engineers to Washington, D.C. as science and technology policy fellows. They provide scientific analysis to policymakers in congressional offices and in federal agencies. Find out more at fellowships.AAAS.org. AAAS, advancing science careers, enhancing public policy.
The challenges in building a scientific career and keeping it afloat can be daunting at times, and helping to meet those challenges is a major focus of science's jobs and career development website, sciencecareers.org. A new column on the site, Opportunities, looks at those challenges from a distinctly entrepreneurial point of view. The column's author, Peter Fisk, was a longtime contributor to Science's online career development site before taking a break in 2001 to start a business and a family. And he's returned this fall to start a new column. He's on the line with us now. Peter, welcome.
Hi, Stuart. Thanks for having me.
Well, Peter, as I mentioned, you've come back to writing with our careers site after a five-year hiatus. Any thoughts about how the sort of project of career development in the sciences has or hasn't changed in that time frame?
Well, sure. For starters, when I left my writing in 2000, it was a very optimistic time, I think, for young scientists. After this period of some uncertainty in the 90s, and lots of anxiety about career directions, there was a growing acknowledgement on the part of universities and funders that young scientists had a broad range of career paths available to them. And I would say that since that time in the last 5 years, there certainly is a greater acknowledgement that academia is not the only pathway, but in fact is not even the most typical pathway. Most graduate students, when you ask them today, will acknowledge that a relatively small percentage of their classmates will end up in academic jobs. I've also seen in the last 5 years a greater appreciation for industry as a career path for science people. And then finally, there's a greater acknowledgement of non-science paths for science-trained people. Investment banking is now explicitly recruiting people with PhD backgrounds in science like physics and mathematics, and that's even being embraced at some universities. On the flip side, there are a number of things that haven't changed. There are still a lot of scientists out there, both PhDs and mid-career and even late-career people, who are concerned or even anxious about their careers and the direction that they're headed. And I also, disappointingly, don't really see much of a change in the overall message coming out of universities. Universities are training graduate students in pretty much the same old ways without much introduction of some of these topics explicitly.
Well, I guess your column, to some extent, is trying to help out with that. One of the themes of your new column seems to be entrepreneurship, but I gather you're defining entrepreneurship as something that goes well beyond something like, for example, creating your own startup business.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when most people think of entrepreneurship, that's exactly what they think of. They think of people starting companies and IPOs and all that sort of stuff. But I have always viewed entrepreneurship as a much broader concept, and I call this little e entrepreneurship. For little e entrepreneurship, I'm talking about a general philosophy of proactivity in one's career and a general philosophy of trying to seek out challenging and important problems to work on in one's career and in one's life. And so when I'm writing in my column Opportunities, I sometimes talk about explicit capital E entrepreneurship topics, such as intellectual property, which is one of the topics we're discussing now. But I also talk about some broader issues about proactivity in your life, about maintaining some ability to balance between your current projects and future projects. You know, these are concepts that I think are natural for scientists, but we just haven't talked about it this way. I think there's a lot of many aspects of being a successful scientist that involve entrepreneurship. And in many respects, you know, being a PI at a university is very much like running a small business.
Well, let's drill down to the subject of your most recent column, which you mentioned was intellectual property, and that's obviously a real hot-button issue in scientific career-making now.
Yeah, no, that's right. I think this is a really important topic. You know, of course, we as technical people, discovery is what we produce. And I think for a long time there has been, in universities in particular, a sort of disdain of intellectual property as a concept. I think that a lot of people have believed that, you know, sharing data and all those selfless aspects of being a researcher are somehow incompatible with patents and those sorts of things. And so I explore that topic very specifically in last month's column and this month's column, and in particular, I'm trying to illuminate for people that intellectual property, the creation of intellectual property, doesn't necessarily hinder the further, you know, advancement of science, but in some respects, the creation of intellectual property can actually help encapsulate an idea and a technology in such a way that it can be more quickly brought to market.
But of course, I guess one of the things that faces young scientists is whether they get some sort of property right to their invention at all. What should a young scientist, or any scientist for that matter, look out for in actually navigating this arena?
Well, I think one thing in particular is most scientists are aware that in doing research at an institution or any employer, intellectual property rights to their work is owned by that employer. And in fact, especially many people in graduate school or postdocs may not realize that one of those many forms that you sign on the first day of your employment includes a form basically signing over your intellectual property rights to your employer. Now, in the case of industry, I don't think anybody would be surprised by that. But in universities, it can sometimes come as a surprise to people that some of the work that they're working on, they actually have to get permission from the university if they're going to go take it out and try to start a company with it. Now, this isn't a problem necessarily. It's just that scientists and engineers need to understand not just the basic concept of intellectual property, literally what is it, but also understanding their responsibilities in terms of generating potential intellectual property and reporting it. There's some times, for example, when a scientist might be working in, you know, area A, but come up with a very important idea in a somewhat or even dramatically different area. Those times, in those cases, might be areas of some uncertainty for a scientist. You know, does this idea that I've just had really belong to my employer or not? There is not an easy answer to questions like that. But one of the things that scientists of all ages can do is first make sure that they understand what agreement they have with their host institution and organization. Are the intellectual property rights that they are assigning to their employer specific to the research that they're doing, or is the language broader? And secondly, when someone is considering departing from a research organization, maybe starting a company based on the research that they did, what are the particular strategies for licensing the technology back from their host institution? And how can they make sure that they don't create a conflict of interest if their technology is being exploited in a commercial environment?
Well, Peter, thanks for being with us today, and welcome back to sciencecareers.org.
My pleasure, Stuart. Thanks for having this conversation with me.
Peter Fisk is the author of the monthly column Opportunities on sciencecareers.org. To read his most recent column, as well as the work of other sciencecareers.org columnists, visit the career development section of the site. Finally today, our usual roundup of interesting stories from Science's free daily news site, Science Now. David Grimm, the editor of Science Now, is in the studio with Tanisha Riley of AAAS.
David, good to see you again. So what's the stories you have for us today?
We've got three stories for you, Tanisha. I'm going to talk about the first negative molecule found in space. I'll tell you about how better sperm begets more boys. And finally, why birds change their tunes when they move to the city.
Sounds like a nice mix. Let's start with the story about anions in interstellar space. For starters, what's an anion?
Well, an anion is a negatively charged molecule, and astronomers know that space is chock full of all types of molecules. Some of them molecules like we've heard of, like carbon and hydrogen and oxygen, other things we may be less familiar with. But all of these molecules so far have been either positively charged or they don't have a charge. And astronomers knew that there must be negatively charged molecules or anions out there because these molecules are needed to combine with the other molecules to form some of the basic building blocks of life. But they've been really hard to find. And the other problem is that a lot of the forces out there in space, like ultraviolet light, X-rays, and gamma rays, are so powerful that they're thought to destroy most of the negatively charged molecules out there. So astronomers have been looking for decades for these molecules and haven't found any until now.
So someone's found these anions.
Someone has found them. A group of researchers at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics in Massachusetts did some laboratory tests and predicted the existence of a negatively charged anion. They calibrated a telescope to look for this anion, and what they found was that when they trained it on a specific two regions of space, they found a negatively charged anion called C6H-, and they found it in two places, in the shell of a gas surrounding a red giant star called IRC plus 10216, and also in a free-floating cloud known as IMC-1. So they were really excited to find what was predicted.
So why is this so important? What's the big deal about this discovery?
Well, it's a big deal because, first of all, they found it in two places. So that means that these things are more common than astronomers thought. And second of all, it really allows them to say, yes, these things are out there, and it's going to cause some rethinking about interstellar chemistry and exactly what's going on between all these molecules in space and how they may have gotten together at some point and formed some of the precursors that eventually resulted in organic molecules and, for much further down the line, life.
Interesting. Okay, great. So now a story about Earth. You have a story about the European deer.
Right. So this story is about sex determination. And I think, as we know, as humans, there's not a whole lot we can do about the sex of our offspring. But things work a little bit differently in the wild. There are examples where creatures can either voluntarily or involuntarily skew the sex ratio of their offspring. In other words, if there is maybe too many males in a population, all of a sudden mothers start giving birth to more females than males. But researchers have always thought this was done on the mother's half. They never thought the father really had anything to play, any sort of role to play in this. So a group of researchers in Spain looked at a group of wild red deer. And what they did was they had 14 males and 344 females. So the researchers collected sperm from these 14 males, and they used that to inseminate 344 females, and each female got sperm from a different male. And what they found was that males with higher fertility sired more sons. So the males with sperm that were causing more females to get pregnant, those females were having more males than females. And they also noticed that the males that were more highly fertile also had better quality sperm than the lower fertile males.
And what exactly counts as high-quality sperm?
That's a good question. They say highly fertile males had normal-shaped sperm, and the less fertile males had misshapen sperm. Now, what misshapen means, I have no idea. but that's at least what they report in the paper.
But why would the more fertile males make more sons?
So they say it's all about getting your genes in the gene pool. So creatures are deemed successful when they get more of their genes represented in the gene pool. And males that are highly fertile are going to produce more sons, and they know that those sons are going to pass on their genes. So that's the advantage they get. And less fertile males, they know they're not going to produce as many sons, so by producing more daughters, the daughters don't have the fertility issue that the males have. And so at the end of the day, it's going to equal out into a 50-50 ratio, where even though the more fertile males are producing more sons, the less fertile males are producing more daughters, and at the end of the day, you've got a pretty even mix of sons and daughters in the population.
So it's like a checks and balance system.
Exactly.
Great. Finally, we have a story about country birds and city birds.
Right. Well, Urbanization has been pretty unkind to wildlife, and researchers have wondered whether birds in the city, in addition to sort of being impacted by the pollution and the habitat destruction that comes along with an urban dwelling, might also change their songs when they're in the city. So a group of researchers compared species of bird known as the great tit, and they looked at the males, because males make songs when they mate and when they defend territory, and they looked at birds in 10 cities across Europe and also in 10 rural areas next to those cities, and they compared their songs, and they noticed that just like people who maybe rush a little bit more when they're in the city and have a higher paced lifestyle, birds in the city also seem to have a higher paced lifestyle in terms of their song. Urban birds sang songs faster with a higher pitch, and their songs were also shorter than the bird songs in the nearby surrounding forests. And it's kind of like if the birds in the forest sounded like Barry White, the birds in the city sounded a little bit more like Michael Jackson. So there definitely seems to be a difference in bird songs when birds live in the city versus when they live in the country.
So how would changing their songs like this help these birds?
Well, they think it has to do with the sounds of the city. The researchers say that cities are full of low-frequency sounds, like sounds generated by cars and trucks and machinery. And birds, to compete with that noise, have to make higher frequency songs. And so that's what they're seeing. The birds are sort of, in essence, tuning to a different channel so that their songs can be heard above the din of the city, but also be heard by other birds out there in the city as well.
David, thanks a lot for sharing those stories with us today, and I'll see you again next time.
I look forward to it.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news service of science. You can catch up with these and other stories on the site at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.
And that wraps up the December 8th, 2006 Science Podcast. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society, with additional financial support from the Golden Fund. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music for the show. I'm Stuart Wills, the online editor of Science. On behalf of the journal and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.